This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Both the U.S. and Iran are signaling that they're stepping back after Tehran's missile strikes on Iraqi bases housing American forces. It'd be Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
The attacks followed America's killing of Iran's top general, a sequence that put the two nations closer to the brink of war. But President Trump says Iran appears to be standing down, and he's indicating there will be no U.S. military retaliation. Instead,
the United States will immediately impose additional punishing economic sanctions on the Iranian regime.
And says they'll remain until Iran changes its behavior. In a White House address, the president says the nation should be happy and grateful the missile strikes did not kill any Americans or Iraqis, in part crediting an early warning system he says worked very well. Sagar Magani at the Pentagon.
A vote set Thursday in the House on limiting President Trump's ability to take military action against Iran. The AP's Ed Donahue has details.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called the drone strike that killed Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, provocative and disproportionate. Democrats like Minnesota's Ilhan Omar say President Trump is too unpredictable.
This is a man who is both an arsonist and a fireman. He starts a crisis, then he wants to create the appearance of wanting to solve it.
House Minority Whip Steve Scalise says now is not the time to hold back the president.
We should all be coming together to support our commander-in-chief to protect America, not debating how to limit the president's ability to defend this country.
A similar bill faces an uphill fight in the GOP-led Senate, and if passed, President Trump would veto it. Ed Donahue, Washington.
And you can find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Puerto Rico slowly began to recover Wednesday from the string of devastating earthquakes that hit the U.S. Caribbean island territory since late December. Its power grid intentionally shut down as a safety measure after Tuesday's 6.4 magnitude earthquake was partially brought back to life. Nearly 500,000 of the island's 1.5 million customers had service again. That's up from 100,000 Tuesday night. The governor, Wanda Vasquez, said that the most of Puerto Rico should have power restored by Thursday, provided that there are no more earthquakes. Meantime, hundreds of families are sleeping in the cars and on cots and chairs outdoors for fear that their homes might collapse in aftershocks or new tremors. More than 250,000 Puerto Ricans remain without power. Authorities in Iran continue to investigate why a Ukrainian passenger jet crashed minutes after takeoff from Tehran's airport early Wednesday, killing all 176 people on board. Reuters' Joe Davies.
The Boeing 737 came down early on Wednesday, shortly after takeoff from Tehran, en route to the Ukrainian capital, Kiev. Its carrier, Ukraine International Airlines, said the plane was only 3 years old and was last serviced just 2 days ago. This aviation disaster came on the same night Iran launched missiles at bases housing U.S. forces in Iraq in retaliation for a U.S. drone strike last week that killed an Iranian military commander. Iranian media quoted a local aviation official as saying the pilot did not declare an emergency. Among the dead are 82 people from Iran, 63 Canadians, 11 from Ukraine, 10 Swedes, 3 Germans, and 3 Britons.
That's Reuters' Joe Davies reporting. Ousted Nissan boss and international fugitive Carlos Ghosn made his first public appearance since a daring escape from Japan, where he's wanted on financial mismanagement charges. Ghosn accused Tokyo prosecutors of brutal treatment and launching a blistering attack on the Japanese authorities and Nissan executives, he says, conspired against
him. I was facing a system where the conviction rate is 99.4%. And I will bet you that this number is much higher for the foreigners.
Ghosn and Nissan and Japanese authorities had colluded for, or says that Nissan and Japanese authorities colluded for two reasons. That's revenge for the French government's interference in Nissan's alliance with Renault and downward in Nissan's fortunes after he stepped down as CEO in 2017. And Japan's justice minister said Thursday that Ghosn's escape from his trial could be a crime itself. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Activists welcome U.S. sanctions on South Sudan's first vice president.
It's important for the U.S. and really the whole international community to be clear that progress needs to be made, and those leaders who have been impeding progress, missing one deadline after another, need to face consequences for that in order for there to be something positive to happen.
Brad Brooks Rubin is the managing director of The Sanctuary, an investigative and policy organization based in Washington, D.C. Sudan's transitional government dissolved dozens of institutions, including four media outlets. More than 6,000 people have died from current measles outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And the European Union reportedly postpones its report on Malawi's 2019 presidential election after strong objection.
If there's anything that Malawians are waiting for, it's not a report from the EU. We are waiting for a judgment from the court, and we don't want anything to destabilize us. We are waiting for the judgment.
Joseph Chidante Malunga is a spokesperson for Malawi's opposition United Transformation Movement Party. And a new research shows the vital link between indigenous people and the conservation of forest landscapes. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Activists have welcomed additional U.S. sanctions, this time on South Sudan's first vice president, Taban Deng Gai. The U.S. Treasury Department said Wednesday that Deng Gai arranged and directed the alleged killings of opposition politician Agre Adri Izibo and human rights lawyer Dong Samuel Luwak to solidify his position in the South Sudan government. The Treasury Department said Deng Gai's alleged action was derailing South Sudan's ability to implement the peace agreement. Brad Brooks Rubin is the managing director of The Sanctuary, a Washington-based investigative and policy organization. He says with the February 12 deadline approaching, it is important for the U.S. and the rest of the international community to make clear that South Sudan parties must reach an agreement on forming a transitional government.
We're very pleased to see it. We think it's an important continuation of the U.S. pressure strategy that's been in place for some time and really very much in recent weeks. The February 12th deadline is looming, and it's important for the U.S. and really the whole international community to be clear that progress needs to be made, and those leaders who have been impeding progress, missing one deadline after another, need to face consequences for that in order for there to be something positive to happen.
Attain, the spokesperson for President Salva Kiir, says that such sanctions would worsen the situation in South Sudan. I was wondering, does the U.S. government have any tangible evidence that Taban Deng Gai played a role in the killing of Agre and Samuel Luwak?
I don't know what evidence they have. They presented in the statement their description of his role, and having worked in the U.S. government my roles, I know they don't make those statements unless they have information and evidence to back it up, and it's certainly been, reported on. His role has been reported on elsewhere. I am sure that they have that information. It is not U.S. actions like this that make things harder in South Sudan. It is the continued intransigence of leaders like Taban and those that the spokesperson represent to fail to progress on key issues and make things better for the people. To say that it's U.S. sanctions that are making things worse is a pretty hollow comment for leaders that continue to, frustrate the progress that the international community, IGAD, South Africa, the Troika, the United States, the entire international community is really united in trying to work for peace on the ground. And it's, and until the leadership is ready to make some difficult choices and move and put the people of South Sudan ahead of their own interests, these kinds of actions need to be taken in order to send that message.
Brad, the U.S. has sanctioned so many people so far in South Sudan. Still, as you said, there is intransigence when it comes to achieving peace in South Sudan. So what can the U.S. do, or what can the world do?
The answer is to use these kinds of pressures along with strong diplomacy. And while you're right that over the last 2 years, the U.S. has really led the way in imposing sanctions on a range of figures and the companies they own in South Sudan, there is more to be done, and certainly more that can be done on the banking side. to impact the accounts of leaders and the companies that they work through to shield the money that they continue to profit from in this conflict. So, you know, there is obviously, sadly, there's no magic wand. There's only continued diplomacy that is supported by strong pressure. That's what we and many others have advocated for. And hopefully, at some stage, when the leaders in South Sudan understand that this kind of pressure will continue and will continue to impact them and their families and their networks, they'll make different choices. And at that stage, the international community should be there to support them in an important way. But, you know, you see that support receding now because the international community recognizes there isn't a serious push towards peace. And until that happens, it has to be more pressure coupled with strong diplomacy.
And talking about serious push to peace, last week we just passed the halfway point of the 100-day extended time to form a transitional government. Yet it seems that nothing has happened so far because I think both sides are blaming each other.
It is disappointing to see that we are so close to the deadline in February without more progress. And we really hope that today's action makes it clear to everyone that progress needs to be made. They are only continuing to hurt the people of South Sudan, people of the region. And it's an important step like the U.S. took today that can help make that clear so that we can see progress in the second half of this period and not come to a point where yet another deadline is missed and yet more suffering is imposed on the people.
Brad, thank you very much again. We're so happy to speak with you. Happy New Year to you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me, and happy 2020 to you and everyone else.
Brad Brooks-Rubin is Managing Director of The Sanctuary, a Washington-based investigative and policy organization. He was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. Sudan's transitional government has dissolved dozens of institutions, including four of the country's media outlets, as part of its campaign to crack down on the activities of members of former longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir's regime. The government says some of the individuals connected to the entities used public funds to enrich themselves, which it says damaged the Sudan economy. Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
The transitional government says a committee it formed to investigate institutions linked to the former regime found that many of those institutions mismanaged national resources to benefit of certain individuals. Speaking in Arabic to reporters in Khartoum, Taha Osman Ishaq, a member of the investigative committee, says the panel agreed to freeze all financial assets of Al-Shuruq TV, Al-Tayba TV, and two Sudanese newspapers they assert receiving funds from Al-Bashir regime for years.
We recommend it to dissolve the Holy Quran Association and freeze all its assets and direct its management to the Ministry of Finance, and should be administered by the Ministry of Religious Affairs. The account of African International University should be audited as from the year June 1, 1989. Confiscation of the National Congress Party's headquarters and freeze all its financial and movable assets.
The committee also dissolved the Sudanese Bar Association and all national and state trade unions. Osman says the committee will work to reclaim all national assets that were privatized by the previous regime.
These decisions are in line with the constitutional document and in line with the law and with the objectives of the revolution, which call for dissolving the previous regime and reclaim the public funds. Some of these decisions are eligible for appeal, but they should do so within the context of the law.
He urged the public to offer any relevant information that would help in the investigation. Sousan Mahjoub, a Sudanese journalist who has worked for Al Sudani Arabic Daily newspaper since 2012, calls the sweeping decision to shut down so many institutions as a violation of one of the core goals of the Sudanese revolution, press freedoms.
To suspend a media outlet at this crucial time is very unfortunate. That is why we are calling on the transitional government, which has been calling for a freedom justice, to revoke their decision. Otherwise, the freedom they are calling for is meaningless.
Mahjoub says her newspaper is a self-funded institution, adding it did not receive any funds from the previous regime. She says her paper will fight the decision.
We will organize ourselves and go to meet the committee and explain to them our situation. We shall also engage other journalist colleagues to to demand the reopening of our newspaper.
The committee was formed in December with a mandate to reclaim all public assets, freeze financial accounts of all entities believed to have been funded by the previous regime, and investigate allegations of government corruption. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 9th. Let's send a shout-out to listeners on these our VOA affiliate stations. Capital FM in Blantyre, Malawi. Kira FM in Jinja, Uganda. Radio Lake Victoria in Kisumu, Kenya. And Rush FM in Bamenda, Cameroon. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. Reports from Malawi say the European Union Election Observer Mission has postponed, at least for now, its report on Malawi's 2019 presidential and parliamentary election after strong objection from two leading opposition parties. Malawi is currently awaiting a ruling from the country's constitutional court on the conduct of the May 21st, 2019 election. Lazarus Chakwera of the Malawi Congress Party and former Vice President Saulos Chilima of the United Transformation Movement, UTM Party, have challenged the results in court. UTM spokesperson Joseph Chidante Malunga says Malawians are looking for a report from their constitutional court, not from the European Union.
I think everyone now knows that the elections in Malawi were disputed, and we took the matter to court, and the process in the court has not finalized yet, and everyone knows that the final moment for the matter in court is the judgment, and right now we are waiting for judgment. And to have an institution, an EU, to say we are coming with a final report, we think this is not correct, and probably tantamount to sub-judicial. That's the reason, major reason, that why we said we don't want this report at this moment. We are not against the contents, but we are against the timing of this. I mean, if there's anything that Malawians are waiting for, it's not a report from the EU. We are waiting for a judgment from the court, and we don't want anything to disturb us as we are waiting for the judgment.
Could it be that perhaps the European Union is tired of waiting for the court ruling and they would like to make clear their position?
Well, whatever they're trying to do, but what we're saying is they are doing it at the wrong time. We don't want them to do it now. They could have done that a long time ago, or probably after the ruling by the Constitutional Court. Then they can say, okay, let's come and look at what we wrote. But at the time when we are waiting for the ruling from the court, I think this is ill-timed.
Your standard bearer, the former Vice President, Mr. Chilima, will he be meeting with the European Union Observer Mission?
No, he's not going to meet anyone at this moment. Maybe after the ruling, he might decide, or he may change his position to go meet. But at the moment, he's not meeting.
Has the European Union decided that they are going to go ahead to publish the report, or have they decided to at least listen to your party's appeal to hold on?
It's not just our party. I have seen another party, Malawi Congress Party, also objecting. I also have seen the Malay Law Society also, you know, agreeing with what we said. And I have also seen a response from EU that they are no longer going to present the report.
What's the atmosphere now as the country awaits this court ruling?
Well, I mean, Malawi has been a peaceful country. It's peaceful, and all people are looking forward to is justice. And everyone is talking about justice. Let's see what the court is going to come up with. And we know actually the reason why we took the matter to court is to seek justice. And we believe that the only institution that can give justice is the court. That's why we are waiting eagerly, and probably that's why we don't want any disturbance. Nobody should come up and say, oh, we want to give you a report and whatsoever. We don't want those disturbances. So we are eagerly waiting and counting down. We know it was going to be 45 days from somewhere in December, and we are counting down. Probably any time, we don't know when, but we're pretty sure that it is going to be soon.
What is your party willing to accept? Suppose the court comes out and said something, perhaps there were some irregularities, but it cannot overturn the results, but it would like for some kind of a unity government to be formed. Are you looking forward to that?
Well, like I said, the reason why we went to court is to seek justice. We are not the people to interpret justice. It's the court. So we will accept what the court is going to come up with. And that decision by the court is what we're going to adhere to, and we believe that it is going to be justice. So it is justice that we are going to accept.
Thank you very much again. Always nice to talk with you. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you very much, my brother. Happy New Year to you too.
Joseph Chidante Malunga is the spokesperson for Malawi's opposition United Transformation Movement Party, who is speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. This week, as residents took to the streets to contest the current measles outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the worst ever in the country, has so far resulted in more than 300,000 cases and more than 6,000 deaths since it started in early 2019. Dr. Vincent Sudinjo, the incident manager for the World Health Organization in the DRC, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the outbreak and the new ways that they are hoping to fight the disease in the coming weeks.
The cases are reported from all the provinces, 26 provinces of the country. Most than 300 health zones were affected by the epidemic.
The routine vaccination coverage is still low in these areas, sometimes around as low as 25%. What is the reason for that?
The first reason is that we are in a very large country where we have huge logistical issues to access some areas. There are a lot of hard-to-reach areas in the country. In addition, we have a long and protracted humanitarian crisis in some provinces of the country, as well as security issues. All these conditions don't allow the ease implementation of a public health intervention. In consequence, the vaccination is not well done in some countries, and we have a lot of children who are not immunized against measles.
Of the more than 6,000 people who have died from the measles epidemic, are most of those unfortunately children?
Yes, the large proportion, more than 90% of the reported deaths, are within children under 5. So it is a very dramatic situation, very sad situation, and it is very difficult to see that people, children, are still dying from disease that can be easily prevented by vaccination. And to avoid this situation, the country has developed now a new strategic response plan for the next 3 months, from January to June. This plan has identified some key innovations to help us to put an end to this outbreak. The first innovation is that we will extend the vaccination to children age who is more than 5 years, children from 5 years to 14 years. The second innovation, we will add a nutrition treatment component on the treatment of people who are suffering of measles. The third innovation, we will improve health education to improve the community awareness so that the mothers will bring quickly children to health facilities to be treated. In addition to that, we will improve local coordination capacity and accountability.
That was Dr. Vincent Sudinjo, an incident manager from the World Health Organization. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Kinshasa. New research out from forest experts shows the integral link between indigenous people and the conservation of forest landscapes throughout the world. These forests are essential in combating climate change, says John Farr, one of the authors of the report. Farr, who has worked in the Congo Basin in Cameroon, talked to Ricky Stryak about how the communities preserve their forests.
This is a completely new map to give us a very good idea where indigenous peoples live and the areas that they, to some extent, control. We've also have had maps of forests that are in the best possible condition, these intact forest landscapes. And when you overlay these two maps for the world, what you see is that indigenous peoples are actually controlling, influencing, managing a very large portion of these very important areas of forests. We are saying that indigenous peoples are custodians of a very large portion of forest land, which are vital not just for mitigation of climate change, but also for biodiversity conservation.
Do you see any threats to this as to the indigenous people's ability to stay on the land, their ability to preserve the forest? Are there any threats to this?
It depends where you are, what you're looking at, of course. There are some situations, it's not unknown that there are many parts of the world in which indigenous peoples are actually finding it very difficult to keep hold of their land. If we talk about sub-Saharan Africa, I work a lot with the pygmies in the Congo Basin. These indigenous peoples in the Congo Basin are actually having a tremendous amount of problems with many governments because these governments are not recognizing the rights to hunt, the rights to move around in lands that have been theirs for millennia.
What are some of the threats to that, specifically, as you mentioned, the Baka in the Congo Basin, I think?
For example, very clearly it's a recognition of the territories that have been theirs, have been used by them for many, many thousands of years in some cases. You're talking about there is a lack of recognition by governments of their status as a people, and there is a lack of recognition of the territorial rights of lands that they've been in for many years. Okay, that's one. The other thing is that there's obviously a tremendous amount of overlap between these lands and things like any industrial extractive industry, like logging, like mining. Now, my feeling, certainly after working with pygmy groups in southern Cameroon for quite some time now, is that there are ways in which we can combine both the use of resources by pygmy people and also the extraction of certain products within those lands. But it needs to be talked with the people.
Dr. John Farr is Senior Research Associate at the Center for International Forest Research. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from the United Kingdom. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The Russian and Turkish presidents are calling for a ceasefire starting Sunday in Libya, where rival governments have been battling for power. Seeking a military solution to the ongoing conflict in Libya only causes further suffering and deepens the divisions among Libyans, Vladimir Putin and Recep Tayyip Erdogan said in a joint statement Wednesday in Istanbul. The worsening situation in Libya is undermining the security and stability of Libya's wider neighborhood, the entire Mediterranean region, as well as the African continent, the statement said. They said illegal migration, weapons trafficking, and terrorism are just some of the problems aggravated by the fighting in Libya. Turkey has begun deploying troops to Libya to help the Western-backed government in Tripoli. Activists have welcomed additional U.S. sanctions, this time on South Sudan's first vice president, Taban Deng Gai. The U.S. Treasury Department said Wednesday that Deng Gai arranged and directed the alleged killings of opposition politician Agre Adri Ezibo and human rights lawyer Dong Samuel Luak to solidify his position in the South Sudan government. And that is it for this Thursday, January 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotin and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barton in Washington wishing you a lovely day.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.